Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Education Hour. And always excited to be chatting with such interesting people and topics. And last week, I kind of opened up a can of worms in the discussion about should we lay off teachers based on seniority or performance. I want to look into this more and more, especially what happened with the whole North Hills school merger in the Diocese of Pittsburgh this year, and how unions should decide, and not just unions, meaning the principals, what protection should there be by the union, and also can we find teachers that can perform better than seniority? So I'm first excited to welcome my co-host Jason, the public school guy. Jason, how are you? We have a topic this week, and we have a very, very interesting guest on the line to be part of the panel. How are you, Jason?
I'm doing well. I'm excited.
All right, and also like to welcome the program, Gerard Teachman, and I always call him Jerry, and he's a former teacher and professor, wrote a book. Jerry, thanks for calling, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. I know anything when it comes to education, you have so much passion, Jerry, about the subject, don't you?
Well, yeah, I taught for a long time. I think teaching is a marvelous profession, but I also think it's much more difficult than most people realize.
Yes, I think that Jason and Jerry are not going to have any arguments tonight. I think I'll have to be the one to kind of put some certain questions out there again for two pro-teacher people, pro-union. But Jerry, in certain ways, it's very interesting you listen to more about what he said. So let's go right to the top again. As I brought up before, what happened in the Diocese of Pittsburgh where they just decided that the teachers that would stay are the ones with seniority. We didn't look at performance comparing two teachers. We only looked at seniority. So, Jason, I'm going to go right off the bat. Do you think this is the fairest way, if you have to lay off teachers, is look at seniority before performance?
Well, I mean, how do you define performance? Because truth be told is, do you define performance based upon, I teach kids at all levels. I teach two AP courses, and I teach some very general courses. I have peers of mine who only teach the advanced kids and peers of mine who only teach the low kids. So define performance.
Okay, that's a great point. I think that you define performance based on, the teacher evaluation process. Has that teacher, how has that teacher shown professionalism-wise? How is that teacher dealing with parents, the administrators, everything in between, Jason. Before you just go ahead and just say, let's look at shock and let's just write in that person stays because of seniority.
No, but see, here's the problem you're going to run into with that is that every school is grossly undermanned at the administrative level. So if you want to add into the mix communications with parents, and all the other things that you mentioned, how you have to actually measure those things throughout the entire year. Most schools have one. If it's an elementary school, they have one principal, or they share a principal. Middle schools have one principal, maybe two. If you get to bigger schools, larger schools, they'll probably have two. And most high schools only have three principals, depending upon size. So you're talking about at my school, which is one of the larger ones in Western Pennsylvania, has three principals. They have 200 staff that they have to manage at the high school level, teachers, aides, custodial staff, etc. So where are these principals going to find the time to be able to do all the measuring that you're requiring them to do? The truth of the matter is, most of the better teachers are the more experienced teachers. And with that being said, and Neil, you're right. There are some teachers who are better, who are younger, et cetera, whatever. But the easiest measure when it comes to seniority, the easiest measure for retention, it comes down to seniority. Now, when you talk about closing schools, outside of school districts, there are different laws that play a role in it. But you're talking about the Diocese of Pittsburgh, and that's within the school district, and they can do whatever they want to do depending upon their contract within their union.
Okay. That's a great point. I wanted to get Jerry's point of view, especially the number of years he's taught and things like this. Do you think that it should be just right there, the chalk, performance versus seniority, and saying basically that you're going to, Jerry, that the person that goes is the one that is not, that does not have the seniority?
Well, I think I, for the most part, go along with what Jason has said. I think the problem that most people have is that we assume in some way or another that all teachers can be categorized as average, good, better, great. And I don't think that it works that way. In the 47 years that I taught, I never found any teacher, myself included, who was great every day, every period, for every year. I was better with some students. I was better in some days. The teaching process is an exchange. It's between the students and the teachers. And all of those things are affected by things that are beyond the teacher himself. And I think that what we have to recognize is that schools function well on the basis, for the most part, of average teachers, by definition, because good teachers and great teachers are an exception. And when you say that that a teacher is average, what that means to me is that teacher is capable of taking a student from here to there in a semester in any particular subject. If he does it in a way that's extremely interesting for all the students or most of the students, then he's a good teacher. And if he does it for some of the students and they develop a lifelong love of that subject, then he's a great teacher. But as Jason pointed out, who's to know that except the teacher and the students? And then how do you evaluate that? How do you accept that? The problem I saw is that there's a kind of a division in all schools between the younger teachers and the older teachers. And a number of people, they have to make that decision, hate the idea of letting go of a young teacher because the young teacher is new, enthusiastic, full of all kinds of great ideas, which is the nature of being a young teacher. If there's a young teacher who's not that, he shouldn't be in the classroom. But what happens as a teacher gets older is that he becomes, or she becomes, a more seasoned, a wiser, a more effective teacher, but maybe not a more popular teacher.
Right,
and as you get older as a teacher, if you're doing it right, you trade popularity for respect. And the those kinds of teachers are usually the older ones.
See, that's the interesting thing about all that. And young, and I'm going to go back to Jason and then have Jerry come right back into this conversation, because I agree mostly with Jerry's saying. But then, Jason, what about why can't teachers have that like newness still after 7 years? And then I want Jerry to go back to that same process.
Why can't teachers have what after 7 years?
The newness, the enthusiasm, the young teachers.
Because they're not new. Because they're not new. A lot of what people do in the first 5 years of teaching is flail. It's wasted energy. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And the older you get, and this goes for any profession. You know, we're talking about teaching here, but this goes for any profession. You know, the first couple of years you do something, you flail, you waste energy, you waste time. The older you get, the more experienced you become, the more economical you become in your activities, the more concentrated. When you do something, you're doing it for a purpose, not because you think it might work, but you're doing it because you know how this works and you know how to, you know, take the next steps. You're managing the room better to try to manage the learning. You know, like Jerry was saying, the older you get as a teacher, the better you are able to manage the room. You have all these different learning types. You've seen this kid before, different name, same problem. So you already have a plan of attack on how to address their issues and then how to solve problems that probably will arise. But the other part of teaching is, and this is where a strict quantitative measurement doesn't make sense, is that teaching is really truly an art form. You know, the relationship between you and your students on a daily basis, that is a learned activity. You have to have a feel for people to really be an effective teacher. You know, because let's be honest, education hasn't changed. Public education hasn't changed since it's really started. There's really been very few innovations in education. That's why the old adage in education is, it's a pendulum swing. What's new your third teaching is going to be new your 23rd year teaching. They're just going to slap a different name on it and put a different bow on it. So the art of education, the art of teaching, can't be measured. You know, it was the old adage about, what's pornography? I know it when I see it. Well, what's art? I know it when I see it. And that also makes it more difficult to put a quantitative measurement on good teacher versus bad teacher versus experienced teacher versus inexperienced teacher. It's not a flat line matrix. It really is a four quadrant measurement system.
Okay.
One of the things that my last 10 years of teaching, I was a department head who I taught three classes. But as department head, I had parents who would come and say, I don't want my son taking Mr. Smith. And I would say, has your son taken Mr. Smith? And the mother frequently would say, no, but I've heard from my neighbors that he's a bad teacher. And I said, if you want me to, I can show you other neighbors who are going to tell you he's a good teacher. I said, if your son has had Mr. Smith and it didn't work, then I will definitely put him in another class. But I won't do it on the basis of rumors. Because good teaching comes down to that teacher's ability to connect with every student in the class. And that is a learned skill. And it takes a while to be able to do that. And I have great sympathy for younger teachers. They're taught teacher programs and strategies when they're in the College of Education. They come out and they get in front of these students. My first year of teaching was in a very affluent suburb of Detroit, and I was teaching seniors. And I was only a few years older than they. And every day I felt like I was going into the Coliseum. And if I made a mistake, I was sure the students were going to put thumbs down. It was the most difficult thing I ever did. I was in wonderful physical shape because I had been working in a warehouse while I was in college unloading boxcars. But I'd go home every day completely exhausted.
Me too, yes.
Because each hour was a brand new experience. And when I became a seasoned teacher, I could walk into class on a Monday and knowing that something strange had happened in the neighborhood over the weekend and just ditch my lesson and do a new lesson that was geared to wherever the students were at. And that's the versatility that comes with age and experience. The teachers, young and old, who teach from a lesson plan every year, the same lesson plan, I think they are able to teach, but I don't think they're able to inspire. And in order to have a school that's filled with those kinds of teachers, you have to be able to allow them to experiment some, but you also have to allow them to age and to get
yes.
to the point where they're comfortable with that.
Great point. So
I couldn't agree more on that.
I know you guys, it's going to be a lot better with Gerard Teachman and Jason the Public School Guy. I have some points to make and bring back out because I still think there's more we can do in this process to make the right choices of teachers. But also then, Jason had brought some points about evaluation process in our hour show tonight. I will definitely get into them. You're listening to 12 Education Hour at 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh. And we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT. We'll get back. Jerry Teachman and Jason the Public School Guy will continue this conversation about teachers, seniority versus performance. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Hour on 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh. And we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT, with Jason, the Apollo School Guy, and also Gerard Teachman. And Jerry brought up a point about, at one point in time, teachers you don't have to be there, they don't need to be the most popular. And I agree completely with that point. But, Jason, I'm going to bring back this whole process of you thinking that there's not a sense of newness that we can continue to live as teachers for 30 years and 35 years. Why is it that we can't have that spark? Why is it we can't have that just that excitement that we had our first couple of years in teaching?
You're being very Pollyannish about this. Well, you're being very Pollyannish about this. It's just not realistic. You go in teaching. I was in the military before I did this. I worked in private. I worked in at Mellon Bank before I got into education. Education is the single most difficult job I've ever done in my life. Period. Bar none. End of discussion. End of paragraph. Ted, at a certain point, you get tired.
You know, but may I just interject something? I understand. I mean, I think that every teacher understands how this particular process works. And we all try to maintain the enthusiasm. I used to teach a class in philosophy of education at the university, and in the first day of every semester, I would ask my students, who were all teachers working on their master's or their doctors, and I'd say, I want to think about this question all semester. Why do good teachers too often become bad teachers? And I think the question is, sometimes the bad teacher, the good teacher, in the process, with all the enthusiasm and with all of the excitement, as he gets older or she gets older, their personal life intervenes. And if they're not able to maintain that balance, and if they don't get the same kind of feedback or some kind of feedback from the teaching process, they lose a little bit of that enthusiasm. And I think in the perfect school, we used to have sabbaticals. Every 7 years, a teacher was told to go out and become a student again, just to rekindle that fire that they need to have. But we don't do that anymore. But we can sometimes.
One of the approaches I use to kind of do what you're saying, to maintain my freshness, is that at the end of every year, I ask my students to anonymously assess me.
I do too.
It's three simple questions. What did you like? What didn't you like? How can I improve? And I walk out the door, if they want to put their name, but they don't, if they want to say, what I am and who I am, and if they want to rip me apart, or if they want to say that I walk on water, none of those things in the extreme are true. But if there's a string of consciousness throughout all my kids, like I need to raise my point level, or I'm being too unrealistic with X, Y, and Z, then I need to honestly look at myself and what I'm doing, because my clientele base is telling me where my mistake is.
Right.
And it's taken me this has been one of the most influential and instructional things that I have ever done in my classroom, and it's made me 1,000 times a better teacher. But to Neil's point, it's also allowed me to maintain a little bit more of that excitement every year, because the kids tell me I need to change this. And if I do an analysis and say, you know what, they're right, then I have to go back and rethink things, and it's fresh for me. The other thing is, and this goes to Jerry's point too, is that once you get established in your teaching process and what you do, we have a tendency to get stale in how we do it. Well, what's going to work for me this upcoming school year in 5 years from now probably won't work. Technology is going to change. Kids are going to change. I have to change, and I have to be willing to change. And that's where that kind of process helps make a difference.
Right. I think it might, the same lesson may work for you in one class and not in another.
In another,
also,
right.
The art that you were talking about of teaching is being able to read who your students are, who your audience is. Entertainers talk about good and bad audiences. You
right.
can have a bad day with students. If something really traumatic happened to one of them, you got to do a different thing. Whatever you're going to present, you have to present it in a different way than you planned. And when I was the department head, I was committed heresy in our district in that I never asked my teachers for their lesson plans. What I wanted from them was a summary of what they did, not a promise of what they were going to do, because as far as I'm concerned, you really don't know what you're going to do until you get into the class.
Right.
If you're experienced and versatile, you go in there with, you know, you're going to teach the Renaissance. But how you're going to teach it depends on how you start it and how the students respond to it. And to be able to plan that in advance, as far as I'm concerned, is impossible.
Yeah, I mean that's so true. And we look at those two things, and I just want to continue the conversation. Jerry and Jason, based on the question, have done a great job of elaborating to get that spark, to keep that spark, to keep that newness. But now, Jason, can we evaluate this? Can we look at two teachers, one less seasoned versus the other, and take all the teachers who have more seniority versus the others and really rank them top to bottom without test scores, with every other tangible that's important to be a teacher in the art of teaching? Jason, do you think that's possible?
Not with the way they currently structure schools, no.
I don't think it's possible either.
Yeah, in the business world, they tell you for every five employees, you have to have one manager.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you go to an effective management structure, you would have to hire, 10 more principals per high school alone. I just don't think you can do it within the current economic structure of education. It's just not possible.
I don't think you can do it. Period. Because in using your analogy, all teachers are managers. The students are their employees, and the essence of being a good teacher is being able to take what you have. If you're teaching an AP class, and I'll use myself as an example, I didn't teach the AP classes. I wasn't that interested in teaching students who were already motivated. What I liked about teaching was trying to get that what I called a marginal student, smart enough but not interested enough. And I wanted to be able to get them excited. So I was a better teacher for those kinds of students than I would have been for AP students. I think one of the things that we can do with the computers now is we can start matching teaching styles with learning styles. Rather than I get the students whose last name starts with S, that we can, if we find students who are not interested, send them to me. And those students who are interested, send them to the other teacher who is much better at it. If
right.
we start matching those kinds of things, I think we'll be more effective.
Well, and the other thing is we have to stop judging teachers based upon what their clientele base is. The assumption is the really good teachers teach the higher-end kids. I can tell you that the best teachers that I have met are the ones who teach the lower-end kids and can keep them engaged. Because
right.
their management skills, their ability to take difficult, opaque language and bring it down to a digestible level. I mean, that's the other aspect of it. But that's a big lift to ask for
right.
people to change the way they look at the world around them.
But proof of what you just said is the look at the university. Professors are not famous for their ability to teach. No. They're there because they're saving the students' trips to the library. They're filled with information, and they can direct you, and they can profess. But motivate, all the years I spent at the university, I think I met three that I felt really knew how to teach and were interested in teaching. You know, they're most of them, there's so many of the professors that are interested in their own research. That's why they're there.
Right.
And then they have these huge classes where you're not teaching ever. You know, you're just talking. But I think that we can restructure classes and do what is, you know, we compare ourselves to what Finland does or what Singapore does. You know, then I have experience in Germany because I lived there for a while. The Germans have a headmaster in their high school, and he's a teacher. And he's the headmaster for 5 years, and then he goes back into the classroom. And all the other administration are not teachers. So the teacher is the focal point, and everybody else is there to make the teacher's job more effective. And the way we structure ours, one of the reasons why, as a man, when I started teaching, most of the men I knew never intended in staying in the classroom, because they, in order to make any money, they had to get out of the classroom.
Right.
But I think if we recognize the value and the difficulty, then we can make it so these teachers don't get burned out, so that they know they're appreciated and they're rewarded. And then it's so wonderful to give them some time off so that they can become students again.
Right.
Because a good teacher should be a lifelong learner himself.
I love that. That's something I've talked about on my show. Jason, I told him about how I would do continuing education courses should be in college. They shouldn't be the in-services that are done, so that teachers continue to become lifelong learners and become more and more knowledgeable in their craft. So we get back, we're going to continue the conversation again. I've loved both conversations so far, but they say it's impossible, and I want to kind of go back to how is this so impossible? Why is it working in any other field so that we can find and get the best teachers? And what kind of checklist should we use? I love the idea Jerry talks about, you know, and having teachers go and be administrators and then come back to the classroom and teach again. Because ultimately, we need to look at models that work well. In the United States, it's all about the best teachers get out of the classroom sometimes. Sometimes, not saying always. And what is there the incentive for them to continue to perform at a high level? Because it's more of, it has to be intrinsic motivation, not extrinsic. You're listening to Total Education Hour on 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh. And we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT. We're going to be back with Gerard Teachman and Jason the Public School Guy, myself, Neil Hammond, will be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Hour on 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh. And we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT. I'm with Jason the Public School Guy and Gerard Teachman. Now, Jason, so far, you guys, I'm just saying there has to be some way to do this in a better way that we can really constantly evaluate teachers, not on the test score, on this, just this, there's a specific component. I almost was on Fox News getting interviewed by Megyn Kelly about this, that I can spot a good teacher, and this is where this is where I have to be the opposition between you two tonight, that I can go walk into a classroom, observe a teacher, and tell if they're a good teacher or a bad teacher by being there for 10 minutes. And there's specific components that I can see. They could have lost control of the classroom. That's not what I'm going to see. I'm going to see specific, tangible evidence that they're a good teacher or a bad teacher. And I was about to go on that with the whole Chicago City school strikes and all that stuff. Now, Jason, there has to be a better way for us to evaluate a teacher, not based on test scores, but based on all the tangibles necessary to be a successful teacher, Jason.
There might be, but I think that it would be way too complex. You'd have to be, in order for there to be good education, there has to be that relationship, that intimate relationship between instructor and student. This is why online learning fails so frequently in that kind of in that respect. How do you come up with a metric that creates a you can't come up with a metric that creates some kind of a learning process that allows for or some kind of a metric that allows for, hey, this is good, this is bad. And I actually challenge you on the idea of within 10 minutes you can determine whether a teacher is a good teacher or a bad teacher. Again, that could be a good day for the teacher. It could be a bad day for the teacher. And you're just catching a 10-minute snippet of a 180-plus day experience. And you're going to tell me that that is going to be the good measurement of whether or not that person is good at what they do for a living? I challenge you on that.
Neil, yes. may I ask you a question?
Sure.
If you had 100 teachers and you had to cut back on 10 and you didn't use seniority, what would you tell the teacher, the senior teacher, that he wasn't as good as one of the lower 10? And how could you possibly prove that to him? Seniority may not be the best, but it is by far, in my mind, the fairest. If you've got a bad teacher and he's got 10 years seniority, get rid of the teacher. Fire the teacher.
Yep.
And,
okay.
You know, there are a lot of people who will say you can't do that because of the union. No, that's not true. The union is not there to protect bad teachers. The union is there to protect good teachers. But the union is also there to protect due process. So if you're going to fire somebody who's been teaching for 10 years and has been satisfactory, you're going to have to follow a procedure to show that he's no longer satisfactory. But if you know that, if you know you've got a bad teacher, then get rid of him. But to fire or to lay off an average teacher because you think you've got somebody who's better will kill the profession. Why would I want to go into a profession where I know that in order for me to stay, I've got to be better than everybody else? I can't be satisfied with just being good. I have to be the best. That's too much pressure.
No, and see, I think that the basic situation is, Jerry, if we could change the way we're doing things, we keep on saying we can't do this. If we could change the way we evaluate teachers.
How?
And,
how, yeah.
See,
I'd love to. I would love to.
What we have done right now in education, and then I'm going to go let you open it back up the floor for you guys. But Jerry got me involved in this roundtable instead of asking questions and throwing darts at both of you guys. If we could finally just say test scores is not the measurement of a successful teacher. Get these administrators
Agreed.
Out here saying, if we can get rid of that completely, throw that out the window, and say specifically enough that we are going to judge teachers based on specific criteria. And if you're not meeting this criteria, we're going to rank you. And if there's some time that we're going to have to let a teacher go, then here we go. Bam.
Well, define the criteria.
See, define the criteria is the simplest way is when we were student teaching. Okay?
You're supposed to do that the first 4 years before they get tenure.
No, but I think it's – see, okay, then we could go into the tenure conversation. Trust me on that one. But no.
Well, no, because
– yeah, go ahead, Jason. Because
you don't have one. We've had this discussion before. You've never had one.
The truth of the matter is most teachers
– well, wait a minute. Okay. Most teachers wash themselves out. If they're not made for education, they wash themselves out within the first 5 years. The washout rate for first year teachers or beginning teachers is somewhere close to 50%. Those that go into the profession, try the profession, and find out this is for the birds and it's not for me. The vast majority of people who stay in the profession are average, just like in any job, every
right.
job, they're average. And then from that point, you have those people who are below average, of which if they're not good enough, like Jerry said, and I love the fact that you said it, wash, you know, fire them. Let the administrators do their job.
Right.
And if they're elite, then you want to keep them there. If you change the metric on this, I don't know how you could. There's a natural washout in education. And actually, nationally, we're becoming very close to where no one's going into teaching. In the state of Pennsylvania,
right,
lost, you know, 63%. It's down 63% the number of people who are even graduating from with education degrees. Schools can't find substitutes anymore because nobody wants to be in this job because of how it's being attacked. And you, Neil, are advocating changing the rules yet again. Although I agree with the non-testing part, because testing is not a measurement of education; it's a measurement of test taking. And you want to add increasing metrics because you don't like the fact that the way that they go by seniority, which is by far the fairest way in which to maintain staffing.
Right, right. And I would like to make just one more observation, in that I think all the reforms in the last 8 or 9 years that I've read about seem to be aimed at improving teacher performance. And I think that is awfully short-sighted. The best high schools in the country are not filled with the best teachers. They're filled with the best students. And that's how success is measured. I taught in two affluent suburbs where we sent our kids to Ivy League schools. These kids were good students. They were not just teenagers who were attending a building. They were good students. And an average teacher can teach a good student. But when you've got situations where the students come to you with problems, and then the school gives you 30 of them in each class, a good teacher can't do anything. Nobody can do anything. If we're going to really teach all of the students in this country, then, and we know how to do it, we have to have the courage and the will to provide the resources that allow for that kind of teaching. You know, if I'm teaching history and you send me a kid who is in dire need of rehabilitation, then don't expect me to be able to teach him history. I need to be able to do a number of things with them, and I can't do it in a group. A good teacher has to take that kid and send him out because he knows he can't teach him, and he knows that kid can disrupt the rest of the students. But we don't encourage that. We force teachers in our inner cities to deal with situations that are absolutely untenable. Excuse me.
Right.
You can't evaluate those teachers. You know, if you give me a teaching situation and then you watch me for a month, then you might be able to tell whether or not I'm a good teacher.
Agreed.
But if you put me in a situation where it's very, very difficult to teach at all, then you're not going to be able to evaluate me.
In the current way we evaluate teachers now. That's what
right.
The current way we evaluate teachers.
Nobody has enough information about an individual teacher. First of all, principals are former teachers, so the only subject matters they know are the ones that they taught. And if you send them into a French class, how is he going to know whether they're doing well? You know, I knew French teachers, if every time a principal came in to evaluate, they would tell the students, I'm going to go back a chapter. And then you'll shine because you guys all know that chapter already.
That's crazy.
We have Spanish teachers that go straight Spanish. Principals come walking in, they just start speaking Spanish to their classes. And the principals have not an earthly clue what's being said.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, every teacher knows how to do the dog and pony show when the principal walks into the room.
Right.
You know, I'm at the stage in my life now where I know teachers who don't even get observed anymore.
No, I wasn't.
Yeah, you know, I mean, where the principals are like, yeah, I know you do a good job here. Just sign this.
Right.
We're good to go. So I mean, again, this goes back to if you want to get really serious about managing teachers, then we need to change the organizational structure of education,
absolutely,
which would mean that the price of education would astronomically rise. We don't have enough principals to do what you're asking, and if we did, the cost of that would be, it's cost averse to the population because most people don't have kids in school and they don't want to pay for it, although they have a direct benefit from it, economic benefit from it. So we can't do anything more than what we're currently doing.
No.
As far as the observational process.
All the countries we've measured ourselves against and come up short all have national school systems. Their teachers are all civil servants. They're paid by the federal government. And we don't have that. I'm down in Florida, and they start the teachers down here at $30,000 a year, and it's and after 9 years they've reached maximum unless they all get a raise. That puts them just about at poverty level if it's a family of four.
That's crazy.
It is crazy.
Equity in pay. So when we get back, we'll continue this conversation. I mean, I still have not been able to give my blueprint of how we can evaluate teachers. Jason says it can't be done. Jerry is more open to this change. I think people will be very angry with this change in the unions, but I think it needs to be done because there are parents out there that wish they would have teachers, most teachers, that truly care. I know there are a lot of great teachers. However, there are a lot of crappy teachers and a lot of mediocre teachers in that process. And how can we make sure that there's a criteria to be a teacher? And how can we manage that? Go ahead, Jerry. All right.
I don't want to I hate to disagree with you, but first of all, I agree with Jason. I don't think it can be done under this present structure. The idea of being able to say that there are good teachers, I've had a student come to me and say, do you remember back in 9 years ago when I was in your class, you said something that changed my life. And I'm grateful to hear that. But I also remind myself that there were 20 other students in there who didn't even hear what I said. That what makes teaching so mystifying is that you do the best you can. I believe every teacher is obligated to go to class every day with the idea of being a great teacher. And I never look to anybody else to determine whether how well I did. I ask myself, did I enjoy this experience? Did I feel that this was an education experience, a good one? If I didn't, then they sure as hell didn't. And if I didn't, I have to ask myself why. But I don't think that anybody else is privy to that information. I believe that people in the schools that I taught at would say that I was a good teacher. But I don't think they'd really have any way of knowing that, and they definitely don't have any way of proving it. And, teachers would love to have merit pay, but we know it can't be done. We know that we can't. First of all, we don't want to do it because it would cause chaos in the rest of the building. But secondly, it's just not something that can be measured. You know, I think, Neil, that when you go into a building and you can say in 10 minutes that this is a good teacher, what are the standards that you are using? First of all, classroom management. So you get that in every German school you go into. So they're all good teachers by that standard. That's because the students are trained to be good. Well, they don't, and you get that in every parochial school for the same reason. But what other criteria would you use?
I have a ton, so then we'll get back. We'll go to that. I have touched a nerve. I knew I would have to with two amazing expert teachers and myself who stayed in the classroom for 7 or 8 years and then said sayonara. I forget, 7 or 8. Just like in pro wrestling, I stayed 7 or 8 years. Is that my usual track before I move on to something else? Oh, no.
Which was harder?
Which is harder? Pro wrestling or teaching? I'd say teaching. We'll get back. We'll continue. You're listening to the Total Education Hour at 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh. And we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT. We get back. Jerry Teachman and Jason Public School Guy and I continue the conversation. Tenure versus performance. And really, can we really evaluate them performance-wise? And I have to be the one to figure it out. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Hour, 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh, and we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT, and I'm with Jerry Teachman and Jason, the public school guy, myself, Neil Haley, and we're talking about this whole tenure thing, meaning tenure versus seniority versus, again, a person's performance. But really the thing that's happened is you're ranking teachers 1 to 100. You guys say it's going to be too impossible, too difficult. Well, and you brought up classroom management. That's just one component. But everything that we evaluate when we were trained to be teachers, all three of us, at one point in time, or even our first 3 or 4 years, those things can be measured. And they can be measured very much. So what am I looking for? I'm looking for classroom management. I'm looking for professionalism. I'm looking for the ability to deal with parents, and which is not always in that evaluation process. I'm looking for the ability to deal with students. I'm looking for the ability to deal with difficulty and challenges. All of these areas need to be, and how they work with administrators and how they work with their counterparts that are teachers. And how innovative are they? Are they making
How do you
changes?
Define professionalism, Neil?
See, that's a good, great point where I'm looking at. Well, how would you define professionalism if you went to go to work at a bank every day, Jason? What you had to do? How do you define
the reason why I said it because you can't – that's apples and kumquats, two completely different ideas. When I teach, if I'm teaching the kids at the upper end of the scale, my AP students, they love, let me give you information, you memorize it, and you give it back to me. They love that. And the moment you give them any kind of thing else, okay, they struggle, right? So that would be considered a more traditional learning environment. But when I teach my low-end classes, you would probably say I was not being as professional as I should be, because these are the kids who are not intrinsically motivated, who are probably involved in more of the extracurricular activities that we don't want kids to be involved in, who have different things. And so in order for me to address those kids and to get across to those kids, I have to talk very differently. I have to use conversation and examples that they recognize that my AP kids would have not a clue about for the most part. So, you know, if you walk into a teacher's classroom, if they're engaged with their kids, but they're using ideas and examples that maybe are not what you consider to be, you know, the best examples, but they're effective for learning, are they being professional or are they not being professional?
The other aspect of that, one of the things that people complain about in the German school system and all these other countries is that they produce better performing students, but they don't produce happier students, and they don't produce more better balanced students, and they don't produce more creative students. The type of behavior that you see in those schools is conducive to being a grad student at the university. I taught philosophy, and I could have said anything, and my students would write it down and give it back to me because that's what they were taught to do. They didn't question me, and they didn't think for themselves. that's not what most of us want as a product. I want my students to be able to grow, to become more independent, to become a little more adventuresome. I used to get very angry at students that would tell me that they skipped my class and spent that hour at McDonald's. I said, if you're going to skip my class, do something more exciting than my class. But don't waste your time. And this is what the really good, in my mind, what the really good teacher does is challenge these students and does a number of these innovative things. And if my department head were to walk in on me sometimes, I would be in trouble because the students aren't all sitting in class and they're all not writing from something that I put on the board. But this was my argument, and I never lost this argument, by the way, partially because of the union. But I told the administration, you can tell me whom to teach, you can tell me where to teach, you can tell me what to teach, but you can't tell me how to teach. That's my profession. And I do that based on who my students are. And that makes it very difficult for them to evaluate. And it makes it very difficult for anybody to evaluate. You know, I don't know this for sure, but I don't think teachers are evaluated in the German school system. I mean, if you've only got the headmaster, how is he going to do it? I think that they feel that if you've gone through the program, that you can be an average teacher, at least, and if they find out that you're not, they'll fire you. But they don't evaluate them.
And Germany is a very strong union
always
country.
Always has been. Right.
So you can't say that unions are protecting bad teachers.
No. Finland has a very strong teachers union, and they're the best system in the country, in the world, supposedly. No, that's.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with unions is the biggest problem. I mean, like I said, we need to re-change how we evaluate teachers. Now, Jason, you are a professional teacher that does so many great things. You're motivated to go to work each day. You can't wait to try new things. That's not all teachers in your building, Jason, is it?
No, but that doesn't make us better, nor does it make them worse. It just makes me different.
That makes you far better than that person because of what you do.
Well, it just makes me different, that's all. And here's the thing. I'm not a popular teacher. My students, they come to my classroom, and because I have very high standards, and I tell them from the very beginning that I have a certain standard. I will not lower it. You will rise to my standard, or you will fail, and I will let you fail. And I tell them that from day one. And then I'm hard on them. We don't do a lot of multiple choice. Matter of fact, we may have one or two multiple choice test questions the entire year. The rest of it's open-ended. I want the kids to think. I want them to challenge the material. I want them to tell me I'm wrong and prove it. And if they can, I'll admit it in front of my class. I was wrong. I just learned something. But that is a scary proposition for kids because they're always taught the teacher knows best and here's what you need to know. It's difficult for kids to do that kind of intrinsic or that kind of complex thinking, although they do it every day in an academic setting, and it's scary. And that because it's scary, kids look at it and say, I don't like that kind of a teacher. But that's
right.
Precisely the kind of teacher that they need because when you get out in the real world, you have to problem solve. So I'm just different than my peers. My peers on a standardized test would be better teachers than me because they teach that better than I do. But when I get my emails from my kids after they graduate, because I basically teach seniors, thank you because in college I had to X, Y, Z, and your class helped me. You know, that's not part of my evaluative process. But yet I feel that I'm getting across to my students in a better way for what they need than some of my peers are. Not that I'm better, because we all have different standards and we all have different reasons and motivations. I'm just different.
See, I think you're better, and so I'll continue that process. You and Jerry show that those intangibles you need to continue to teach. Doesn't mean the warm fuzziness that they try to teach us female teachers to male teachers. It's the basic fact that you guys come to the table and care about the kids. And
Neil,
all those people. Yeah,
Neil, have you ever heard a celebrity stand up and say, I want to thank my mother and father and so on, and I want to thank all the teachers I ever had? They all talk about one teacher or two teachers that changed their life. And the rest of them they don't remember. But the rest of them taught them too.
Mm-hmm.
The two teachers inspired them. But the rest of them taught them. And it's how would you evaluate them? You know, it's just a process. It's like trying to determine whether or not somebody loves somebody better than another person loves somebody. You can't measure this. If you've got teachers who care, and if you have students who want to learn, then they're all in good shape. And if you've got a teacher who doesn't care, then the administration should find some way of removing him from the classroom, because that's the cardinal sin.
Exactly. All right, Jerry, where can we find information on you about your book and stuff? You can get it on Amazon, is that right, Jerry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's about how I tried to become a better teacher over the 47 years that I taught and what I learned in the process. But I think that you know, I'm a teacher advocate because I feel that most people really don't understand teaching. It's such an important part. In my mind, better education is the best answer to any problem we have across the board, and we know how to do it. Now, I taught 15 years in the inner city, and then the other almost 15 years in the suburbs. So I have the comparison. I saw great teachers in the inner city, but they cried every day because it was such a difficult job that they were told to have. And the state was, at that time, was putting $5,000 behind each student.
Wow.
And in the suburbs, they were putting $12,000 behind each student.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
You know, if it takes $12,000 to educate somebody from an affluent suburb, it's got to take at least that to do somebody from the inner city.
Uh-huh.
Definitely. All right, Jerry.
Everybody should know that.
Well, we're out of time. Thank you, Jerry. And thank you, Jason, for your conversation. And we'll have to continue to look at this. And Jerry, we'll welcome everyone to come on when we have a pretty interesting topic to talk about teachers and stuff. So thanks again for calling, both of you.
I'd love to.
It's been a pleasure,
guys. Thank you very
much.
And Jason, it was a pleasure meeting you. And
Same here.
You know, teachers are a lot like Marines. We don't think anybody really understands us unless they've been through our boot camp.
That's a true story.
Well,
have a good night, guys.
Take care. All right, see ya. All right, that's the show, guys. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.